about the D.C. Circuit Court ruling upholding the EPA regulations. We're so conditioned to, you know, negative news. It's almost like, well, I don't. My husband said, well, you should be happy, you know, yesterday. This is good news. I said, yes, it is. Just, there's so much bad news. But yes, it is.
It's telling, though, isn't it, that all our good news is that attacks on things failed. Like, that's pretty much the best we can hope for these days.
Good point. Good point. DR, want to weigh in before we move on to other topics?
Yes, in reference to the D.C. Circuit Court ruling. David, I don't know if you've had a chance to read through it yet. I had a chance to do so this morning. And the one thing that struck me is that the industry groups that tried to sort of throw out the EPA's endangerment finding on greenhouse gases made arguments that were so sophomoric and so blatantly stupid that from a certain perspective, I'm not surprised that the Reagan appointee on that panel joined the two other judges involved in that case, because I was thinking to myself that the Reagan appointee must have read the sloppy, silly argument and said to himself, I might be a conservative, but I don't want to damage my own integrity by siding with these plaintiffs when they make such absurd arguments. They brought up ClimateGate as a rationale for why the EPA endangerment finding should be thrown out. And as the court noted, nothing in ClimateGate negates the science that the EPA used to make the endangerment finding. So I don't know if you've had a chance to read through it, but if you have, if you did, were you also struck by the transparent silliness of the plaintiffs' arguments?
Yes, my favorite line from the decision was, the EPA shouldn't have to reprove the existence of the atom every time it addresses a scientific question.
Exactly.
I mean, the contempt these judges had for the arguments before them from the industry groups was pretty notable, I thought. This is the problem of having a right-wing media that is so insular, and they all talk to one another, and they don't talk to anyone outside their bubble. They convince each other that these ridiculous arguments carry some weight, but the minute they have to come outside the bubble and address someone who's not, you know, a sort of committed ideologue like them, they don't have any sophisticated arguments. They don't have any good arguments. So it serves to work the base up, but it also has disadvantages. This sort of what's called epistemic closure on the right has its disadvantages, too. You can't convince anyone outside your circle of anything.
Well, let's hope it's reflected in the voting in November, the bubble effect.
We'll see.
I mean, could you believe, Dave, that not one of the Republican candidates for president, ever mentioned climate change, other than maybe in one of the debates a passing reference to nuclear and how much they're for it? It's not to be believed that all of them, with the exception of one who got out early, said they didn't believe in climate change.
I mean, I don't actually find it that hard to believe. Maybe I'm too cynical, but I mean, the situation we have now is one entire party is owned by fossil fuel companies, and about half of the other party is. So you have really about half of a political party that cares about this, and and even out of that half of a political party, you only really have one or two representatives in Congress that are really exercised about it, that really care about it and make a point of saying stuff about it. You know, your Bernie Sanders or Ed Markey, people like that. So there's no margin in it for politicians. There's no upside for them. There's a lot of downside. They'll get attacked by a very activated and angry right-wing base, but they won't get commensurately passionate support from anybody from the environmental base. They won't. So there's a lot of downside and no upside to mentioning it. So those political incentives being what they are, it's pretty predictable that they would all clam up about it.
It's such a shame, especially when you do hear responses there. So when you do hear responses from members of Congress, they're so passionate and so committed. You had Sheldon Whitehouse a couple of weeks ago and John Kerry a few days back, just an impassioned speech. And you just wonder, can anybody measure up to that? And then you try to see coverage of that in the mainstream media of those speeches. And, I'm from Massachusetts, John Kerry's hometown, and I could barely find any sort of coverage. So it sort of proves your point that, you know, there seems to be not a lot of upside politically, at least directly, to speaking out, even though it's a problem that's going to affect so many people. You know, the downside will be the everybody being underwater, basically. So it's like, you know, you need leadership, but there's not an immediate reward to that leadership.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, this is a problem not about persuasion, but about power. There's been plenty of persuasive arguments made, and Kerry's speech was great, and it was not the first great speech even he has given on the subject. But the incentives of power, you know, who gets money, who gets donations, who gets reelected. Those are the incentives that need to shift. The persuasion is sort of tangential, I kind of think.
Well, and speaking of that, you know, as I was watching John Kerry's speech twice, because I really thought it was masterful. He has, you're right, spoken out about climate change in the past quite a bit, as has Al Gore. And yet, what do those two gentlemen have in common? They both ran for office of the president, both got the urgencies of climate change. Way back in 1988, they were both testifying in Congress together, as Kerry pointed out in his speech last week. And yet, when they were running for the White House, they didn't really show their green side often and loudly enough. And I would say that might have helped them, certainly, you know, as close as it was with Gore and Bush. It could have backfired, I suppose, now that we know just how crazy half of America seems to be. But, you know, it could also have made the difference in a positive direction, do you think?
You know, that's an eternal debate, and I know enough about campaign mechanics now to know that predictions or retroactive predictions on my part are pointless. But I mean, I think we can see an example of Obama, who said some very bold things about climate change and had a very bold plan regarding climate change when he was running, and got in office and quickly discovered what I was saying before. There's lots of downside to this and virtually no political upside. So, you know, you've seen it's disappeared from him, too. Ultimately, the problem is not about what's in the president's mind or heart. The problem is about where's the power in America? And you know, they have fossil fuel. They have a lot of money. They have a lot of billionaires, and they have a lot of fossil fuel companies on their side. The only thing that the left has that could possibly compensate for that is grassroots power, and there just is not enough grassroots power aligned behind climate solutions to make a difference in D.C. And until that changes, it won't matter what the president does or says.
I guess you're saying, as strong as the special interests are, and we know how you know, omnipresent they are and deep and wide they go, you'd think that self-interest, though, would really rule the day. But, you know, even though more Americans must be connecting the dots between these extreme, damaging, destructive weather events and climate change, just to name one aspect of global warming, you'd think self-interest would win out. But it doesn't seem that that's the case, and probably you know, one of the issues is we're not seeing it reflected in government leadership or mainstream media.
Yeah, I mean, the reason climate change is, you know, the reason they call it a wicked problem or sometimes a super wicked problem is that the fact is efforts we make today to mitigate climate change are going to be for the benefit of people who live in the latter half of this century, and maybe even people who live after 2100. And it's so the benefits of our action are not going to accrue to us. So that's a political problem. And also the damage of climate change, the impacts and the suffering are going to hit other people and other regions well before they hit America. So it's not really self-interest. What you're talking about is generational, you know, is generational awareness, is changing the way we live to do right by our descendants. And that notion, that very idea, has completely fallen out of American culture and American government. I mean, it's challenging for any government anywhere, but particularly in America, this idea that we could ask people to sacrifice so that their grandkids could have a better life is just, it's old-fashioned at this point and out of style.
David, it's when you say that, I listen to it and I think to myself how it's a profound shame that, you know, we've had generations past, people said we need to fight fascism in part to protect the freedom of future generations. We need to fight communism in part to protect the freedom of future generations. We need to fight, you know, religious extremism in the name of protecting future generations. But when it comes to fighting pollution, it seems that people aren't motivated enough to sort of lead that fight in the name of protecting future generations. It's very, very odd. I keep remembering. I can't remember who specifically said it, but if we could come up with some sort of a name, pollutionism or something like that, you might be able to galvanize people to lead the fight against climate change. But it just seems that there's something in this generation where the focus that previous generations had about taking care of a problem now so that our children and grandchildren don't have to deal with it, it seems that focus is gone in this generation.
Well, I mean, it's tough because the time lags are so big in climate, even more so than war, more so than, you know, economic sacrifice. The time lag between our actions and the benefits, or our actions and the impacts, are so long, it's just tough psychologically to have people have a visceral sense of that connection. And also, all those previous sacrifices are about enemies with faces, you know, enemies that you can see and touch, things that you can materially feel in your own life, and this notion that our collective action is causing this problem, and that all of us are implicated in causing the problem, that all of us are, in some sense, the enemies, and that there's no sort of, you know, there's no sort of Muslim terrorists, there's no sort of scary brown faces to put on TV to frighten people about this. It's just us. That also makes it psychologically difficult. I mean, it's just not a problem that human psychology is well designed to address. So that's one of the huge barriers that Greens have to work around, is how to figure out how to frame this problem, or how to make this problem visceral. And it's a huge, huge challenge that nobody's really cracked yet.
And the complexity of climate change is something you tackled in a recent TED Talk called Climate Change is Simple. I wish every American could just watch for, you know, those 15 minutes where you really laid it out much, much more efficiently than even Al Gore did in his training.
Well, my experience of watching people do these talks on climate change, and this is even true for Kerry and Gore, and, you know, I saw James Hansen's TED Talk, and their head is so filled with this information that they've gathered that they really want to convey a lot of it. They want to explain, you know, thermohaline ocean cycles, and they want people to understand the dynamics of ice flows, and they just, you know, they want people to understand the mechanics of the problem. I hate to be cynical, but the general population does not have a solid scientific understanding of almost anything. And the idea that we're going to have to wait until we've had like a gigantic national seminar and everybody's well educated about science before we can do anything about this, to me, is crazy. So what I wanted to do is just put almost all the science aside, the details of the science, or the mechanisms of the science aside, and just explain what's happening. It's this much warmer so far. This is how much warmer it will have to get before horrible things start happening, and this is how much warmer we're currently on track to get, you know,
as usual. Well, it's brilliant, and we'll put a link up on our website. I know, DR, you've got to jump off in a minute. Just one more question for you, David, and I just want to get your reaction to the recent data showing that only 1% of all news coverage is about environmental issues, including climate change, and that's about the same percentage as celebrity news, which surprised me. I would have thought celebrity news was much greater, given what's on as my teenage daughter turns on and watches the TV, a lot of crap, but she's a teenager. So the fact that 79% in that same poll said they would like to see more coverage, better coverage, wider and deeper coverage of green issues, is both depressing and encouraging. I just want to get your take on that. And you and I have been talking a long time, and there's still not one green radio show on in mainstream media, commercial media. There's Living on Earth, and then online there's Grist and Tree Hugger is the big ones. I've been at it for a long time on the internet now. And do you think that could be part of the problem in terms of the disconnect?
Well, I do think media coverage makes a big difference. I think if you ask people on a poll, do you want more environmental coverage, they'll say yes. But if you stick a remote control in their hands, they will vote differently. They will go
reality watch show.
They will go watch something that has a human narrative, a relatable human narrative about it. That's what people are attracted to. I mean, I really think it does us no good to sort of scold the American people about not being serious enough and not watching the right kind of things. I think it's much better, it's incumbent upon us to think about how can good information about climate change be integrated into the stories and venues where Americans already are. Like, how can we get climate change out into pop culture? How can we get, you know, just not any complicated science, just the basics of the problem, the structure of the problem. How can we get that reflected in you know, sitcoms and TV shows and in, you know, it needs to be ambient in culture. People are not going to come to a specific media venue to hear bad news. That's just not how people are built, you know. So, I mean, the problem, you just have to accept that humans are humans, and you have to figure out somehow how to get, you know, on their wavelength and get this kind of news and packaged in a way that they can feel it.
Well, I do agree that it needs to be woven into the tapestry of our, you know, overall culture. But I would disagree in that. I think, I mean, having interviewed environmental leaders for 15 years, what I love about this is shining the spotlight on, yeah, sure, the problems and the grim statistics, but also what's being done and the solutions and also some of the energy and passion and, yes, humor out there in the sustainability movement. You know, if you've been to conferences, which you have, you know, these are among the most charged up people out there. That's kind of one of the ironies, and I would love to be able to share that infectious enthusiasm, even though it is gloom and doom, with, you know, the American public. I think there is that. Programmers have that assumption, you know, presumption that it's going to be gloom and doom and grim and not at all engaging and compelling, when I think it is, this content.
Well, we're
in a crazy.
we're in a weird situation right now where most Greens, committed people, educated people who care and read about this stuff like us, know that there's this great story to tell about a sustainable, prosperous, more sociable, walkable, just sustaining future. There's this great story to tell about things and things that are being done all over the place that are interesting and forward-looking. We know this, but that story has not gotten out of the green bubble at all. If you go ask a person on the street at random, what do you expect to hear from environmental news? Just flatly ask them that. They will expect to hear bad news. So this to me is the essence of the challenge. How do you tell that positive story, and how do you get it out into public? And honestly, like, the public reputation of environmentalism and environmentalists is an impediment to that. People have very strong cultural associations with that are not good.
Yet they're wrong. So I think the answer is to get grist out there in the mainstream, get shows like this out there with voices who have been at the other end of my interviews all these years out there. I think that's the only way to do it. You'll never convince them. You're right. We just have to show them. So we're trying to get Al Gore to give us a shot on Current TV. We figure if Mr. Gore doesn't think there's a need for a climate show on green issues, then it's time to hang up my mic.
Yeah, if he does.
It's kind of surreal trying to convince him with his own quotes how urgent things are. Well, we are out of time, Dave, but I really appreciate your comments and all the work, great work that you do at grist.org. Everybody should check them out. I always recommend you. I'm doing green tea parties in my home, and you're one of the things that I think green your eco-IQ, go to Grist. And by the way, out of some 100 women I've had over in my progressive community to talk about what's going on environmentally, only one knew the significance of 350 in the context of climate change. She was the only one also that happened to know Bill McKibben. Of course, they go together. And guess what? She worked for Sustainable San Rafael. She worked in the environmental community. So we do have our work cut out for us. Thanks so much. And thanks, DR. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be speaking with David's colleague, and that is Greg Hanscom. He was just down in Rio for the summit. We'll find out if it was worth it, those 3,600 tons of CO2 generated by just the UN delegation alone. Stay with us.